Welcome to Lag BaOmer. This morning is Lag BaOmer. We have the opportunity of learning on Lag BaOmer, and we're going to do today a very interesting thing. We're going to learn about one of the heroes of Lag BaOmer today, and his name is Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva is one of the heroes of Lag BaOmer. He's one of the people who had to persevere through the loss of so many of his followers and the salvation which occurred on Lag BaOmer. Of course, his student was Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, was a student of Rabbi Akiva's as well, also very much connected to Lag BaOmer. So we're going to take a little bit of perspective from the world perspective of Rabbi Akiva himself. Now, to start off by thanking Yon and Ruchi Hamlet, who are sponsoring this morning in absentia, on a Mazel Tov on the birth of a granddaughter yesterday afternoon. Nemetz Hashem, she should grow up the Torah, the Chuppah, the Masim Tovim. And we wish a Mazel Tov to the Stametzers, who are celebrating the birth and naming of Chaya Riva yesterday, which is very special. Chaya Riva off to your mother, Ellen. Emes Hashem, she has big shoes to fill. Emes Hashem, she should fill them and bring nachas to you and the entire Mishpacha. Always. And to Rabbi Steinmetz and to the entire Mishpacha. I'd like to share with you a journey of discomfort and exploration, and maybe perhaps some of our journeys converged in the same way. And let's try to understand what's going on over here. I don't know if anybody here, just by show of hands, anybody has a chance to visit the Temple Institute, the Machon HaMikdash in the Old City of Jerusalem. Okay, a fair share of people. So those who haven't been there, Machon HaMikdash is a temple institute in the Old City of Jerusalem. You can organize tours there, and it's a very fascinating exploration. Even those who've not been there probably know of their work vicariously. And that is because if you walk in the corridor down the old Roman marketplace, you will see there's actually a picture here, I just put in the sources, there's a beautiful golden menorah. And if you look very carefully on the glass which surrounds it, it says that is created by the Temple Institute. The Temple Institute is an organization which has dedicated itself to creating the Klei HaMikdash, the elements needed in the base of HaMikdash, the Asid Lavoi, that we're going to need as the base of HaMikdash is built. And if you go into it, it's really a fascinating tour. Really, I mean, they have such incredible detail. It's such a, I would say, lost art. You know, spending so much time in exile, we've really lost the taste of what it means to understand what Geula, what the Beis HaMikdash looks like, what it means to have a Beis HaMikdash, Bizman Hazeh. And the only thing is that, you know, for my first experience there, I don't know if anybody else had this experience, it feels a little bit uncomfortable. I mean, it's almost like, you know, it's almost like we're pushing the envelope quite far when you go to the Machon HaMikdash, to the degree of what they've done. The Klei HaMikdash, there's a picture of the Shulchan over here. There's a golden Shulchan, which is on the right-hand side. It's really remarkable to learn. As a educational tool, I think we all feel a greater sense of comfort. As a replica of what the Mikdash, or as a real image of what should be used in the base of the Mikdash, feels a little uncomfortable. The reason why it feels uncomfortable, I don't know if anybody else has that sense sometimes when exploring the Machon HaMikdash. The reason why we have that sense of discomfort is a very simple reason is that because we're educated in the absence of such a perspective. Meaning, the way we were educated in, we'll call it, I don't know, everybody calls their stream of Judaism a mainstream Judaism. The way we were educated in our stream of Judaism was not like that. Why? Very simply. Here's how it goes. There's numerous times where we'll see in Chazal and in the Mefarshim later on that this is not the way it works. Example, the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah Daf Lamed starts talking about this day called Yom HaNeif. Yom HaNeif is what is a takona that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai makes, that usually you can only start eating the new produce of the year, of that, let's say, grain which took root this year. You can only start eating it after the Korban HaOmer on the following year, which is the second day of Pesach. That's called Chodosh and Yashan. You can only start eating the last year's produce once you actually have, there's the deadline you've reached of the Korban HaOmer, when the Korban HaOmer was brought. When was the Korban HaOmer brought? So, what time of day? So, it was Machras HaShabbos, but it was brought actually as early as possible in the day in the morning. So, probably around, you know, mid-morning, that's when the demarcation, now everybody in Israel is allowed to start eating all those great flour products which were produced in the last year. Fantastic. The problem is when the Beis HaMikdash disappears, what do you do now? What do you do? How do you? When do you say you're not allowed to be eating this new chalash? And the Gemara starts saying, well, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai made sure that Yom Hanef Kulay Asur, the entire day you couldn't eat, the entire 16th of Nisan, you had to wait till evening. And the Gemara says because maybe the Beis Hamikdash would have been built at some point in the middle of this process, and you'll make a mistake. In and amongst this whole discussion, the Gemara makes a suggestion that maybe the Beis Hamikdash could be built later on in the day, or early on in the day, and there's a number of descriptions of when we could imagine the Beis Hamikdash being built. Rashi, commenting on this Gemara in Source 2, says, number of the descriptions in the Gemara over here indicate that maybe the Beis Hamikdash could have been built at night. Maybe it could have been built on the 15th at night, which is on the first day of Yom Tov. But Rashi says, we know there's halachas. You can't build the Beis Hamikdash in Yom Tov. You can't build the Beis Hamikdash at night. So how could the Gemara even go so far as to suggest that's when the Beis Hamikdash should be built? So the Gemara concludes, Ahani mili binyan bidei adam. Yes, that's true. When we built the Beis Hamikdash, there were limitations as to when we could actualize that. However, aval binyan ha'asid lavoi bidei shamayim hui. The future building of the Beis Hamikdash is going to be not human built, it's going to be celestial. The Beis Hamikdash, as is described, is going to descend from heaven, you know, in fire, all those pictures that we see on the sides over there, the pictures that we all imagine of the Beis Hamikdash being built, is going to be this remarkable, miraculous description of the Beis Hamikdash descending. So we're schooled, and we've been schooled, this is really what a lot of us here in our bringings up, is that how's the Beis Hamikdash going to be built? Is Hashem will do the job for us, and we'll sort of sit by and be the passive bystanders to the whole process. In fact, this is what the Zohar itself says. In Source 3, the Zohar says, the begin da is bani beis bei migdash al yadar dekut shabrichu ho yehei kaim ol dori dorin. So the Zohar says, of course, in Aramaic, that because it's going to be, this future beis migdash is going to be built by Hashem, then it'll never be destroyed. It'll be indestructible. Because when it's built by human beings, then it's finite. And finite things have a parameter and an end. When it comes to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem is going to build a third Beis Hamikdash, and it's never going to have an end. So that's what the Zohar says. And this appears in many, many sources. And I feel that that's our default schooling has been in such. Which is why we have a discomfort when we see people who are sort of doing that job, right? Why are you doing that job? Why are you talking about building the Beis Hamikdash? So it happens to be, Rashi is not the only party in town. Rashi is not the only stream of thought in Judaism as to how the Beis Hamikdash should be built. The Zohar is not the only stream of thought. Well, if you take a look at the Rambam, and what we're going to spend a little bit of time today doing is learning the last two chapters of the Rambam in Hilchos Melachim, where he talks about the future. Very fascinating topics that the Rambam covers. We're going to discover some of them together. The Rambam says very clearly, the first halacha in Perek Yud Aleph, this is really towards the end of the 14 books of the Rambam, and he's describing what it will look like in the future. He says, HaMelech HaMashiach Asid La'amod La'achzir Malchus David Li'yoshna L'memshela HaRishona. So the Melech HaMashiach is going to come, and he's going to now reestablish the kingdom like it was at the beginning. U'bonya Migdash U'makabet Nidche Yisrael V'choizrin Kol HaMishpatim B'yamin And he's going to come and he's going to ingather all the lost peoples around the world and he's going to build the Beis Hamikdash. Right? He's going to facilitate that. He's probably going to get a very good team, architects, builders. We can imagine in the Machon HaMikdash they talk about, you know, will there be air conditioning in the Beis Hamikdash? I'm sure they have like Nest, you know, like regulated, you know, depending on which room. We can imagine underfloor heating, right, for the cold days. We can imagine all the options that would be involved. The Rambam says, Tachlis, who's going to build the Beis Hamikdash? It's going to be us, right? It's going to be human beings, facilitated naturally by Melech HaMashiach. We're not going to push anything. But nonetheless, it's going to be human-led, initiated perspective. Similarly, the Rambam himself and the Sefer HaChinuch, when counting the mitzvahs, talk about one of the mitzvahs is, in the next source, we're not going to read it inside, but the Sefer HaChinuch counts as the 95th mitzvah of the 613 is to build a Mishkan / a Mikdash. Now, if the mitzvah was only building the Mishkan in the times of the desert, that's not a mitzvah ladoros. That's not a mitzvah which is related to all of us at all times. The fact that he codifies it as a mitzvah means to say, who's he speaking to? Us! We have a part in that mitzvah. It wasn't just the Dor, Dea, the people living in the times of the desert who had the responsibility of building the Mishkan. We too, like them, have such a responsibility. In fact, it's actually very educational for us to take a look and start rereading the Sefer Ezra and Nehemiah. Sefer Ezra and Nehemiah is about the building of the second Beis HaMikdash, which was very humble in contrast to the first Beis HaMikdash. And that kind of perspective is somewhat akin to what we're experiencing today, where things aren't exactly smooth. Things don't go in one foul swoop. There's breaks and there's stops and there's politics and there's naysayers and there's enemies and there's money problems. All the kinds of things that we are meeting today are things which occurred in the building of Bais Sheni. The question is this the format for the Bais Shlishi or not? And some people will say, no, the Zohar and Rashi and Tosfos and many of the other Mephoreshim will say, no, it's completely different. Whereas the Rambam says, no, it's the same format. That's how it's going to work. So this type of dispute over here is where this difference in perspective on how the future looks. And this actually extends itself to another few dimensions. So I'd like to explore with you, I'd like to just take you on a little bit of a journey. That was something which was really remarkable to me. I had an opportunity about 3 years ago. Shmuel Grossman, who's a neighbor of ours, invited Rabbi Yosef Carmel, who's the Av Beis Din of Eretz Chemda in Israel. Eretz Chemda is a remarkable institution which deals with very sophisticated halachic legal issues. It's a Beis Din. It's very prolific in terms of its writings. You have a chance to read some of the writings. Really remarkable. And if you ever have a chance to hear Rabbi Carmel in town, it's worth every moment of it. We were talking about somebody who's really a true Talmid Chacham through and through, and he has a very interesting perspective on life. And so 3 years ago, this Shabbos actually, Bahar B'chukhoisa, coming up, and he was giving a small little gathering at a neighbor's house, and I had the opportunity of going, and he talked about this particular Rambam, and he said, but it's more than this. It's not just about how the Beis HaMikdash is built. It's also, this perspective shift actually overflows into other realms as well. So yeah, he gave two examples. I'd like to explore them with you a little bit. The next place that it affects is what will actually happen in the times of Mashiach. Meaning, what if you were to take a picture of before and after, right? And you were to say, what does Mashiach look like for us? So how do we? What are we supposed to imagine? How different is it supposed to be? How transformative is the Mashiach process? So if you want to understand this, the one place to look, there's many places to look, but one of the places to look is actually in Yeshayahu, one of the Haftorahs we read recently, about what Mashiach will look like. Now, just to be careful, I know that sometimes certain issues are conflated. There's the notion of what's called Olam Haba, and then there's the notion of called Yemos HaMashiach. Those are two different stages. Yemos HaMashiach is the times of the Messiah is going to be when sometime in our lifetime, Merev Yomeinu, in the human scope, we're on the same plane, there's going to be a Mashiach who comes and is going to save us and take us into a state called Yemos HaMashiach. That's not Olam Haba. Olam Haba is a stage, according to most Jewish thinkers, is going to be a stage in the very, very future when the world ends. And then everybody gets in, the question is, are you in or out of Olam Haba, which is the time where we receive our ultimate reward. Yemos HaMashiach is still in Olam Hazeh. It's still within the confines of this world. It's just somehow easier. It makes things, it's easier to serve Hashem. I'm going to see how. Okay, so just to deconflate those two terms. Okay, very different. One's spiritual, one's physical. So how does Yemos HaMashiach look? How do the times of Mashiach look to us? How different is it within the confines of this world? How much does nature warp itself? That's the question that's at stake. So let's take a look at what Yeshayahu HaNavi told us. And then let's try to get a perspective on this. This is one of the most beautiful passages in Tanakh. And although we may not be familiar with it automatically, we will see echoes of ideas that we've heard across our lives many times. Here we are. He says, let's do the first 9 psukim quickly. So he talks about there's this root that will come out from the roots of Yishai, from, of course, the Davidic dynasty. And this person is going to be endowed with all this wisdom, this divine wisdom. Who are we talking about? This is the Melech HaMashiach. This is the sprout from the Davidic dynasty. As we're talking about the Melech HaMashiach. And what does that literally mean? Just to be very careful here. So that the translation is not correct here. And he shall delight shall be in the fear of Hashem. Actually, what Aricha literally means, he'll smell. Okay, so it'll be completely saturated. He won't judge based on simple senses. There'll be something more than that. And he's going to now take up this is the social justice aspect. He's going to judge all those who are downtrodden. And he's going to smite. It's a wonderful word you can only use in the context of Tanakh. He's going to smite the evildoers. He will be good with righteousness and emuna. And then famously, v'gar za'evim keves. And there's going to be, the wolf is going to dwell with the lamb. V'nomerim gedir bots, and the leopard will lie with the goat. V'egel kfirim riyach tov v'nar katon no hegbom. And the lion and the calf will all be lying together. And a little child is leading them all. Uparav adov tiren on the, and the cow and the, and the bear will feed together. Yachtov yirbutsu yaldehem va'arye bekabakor yochal tevan, and the lion will eat straw. V'shashua yonek al churposan, and the child will play by the viper's hole. Va'al mu'uras itzifoni yagamul yadoy hada, and he'll put his hand into another types of serpent's den. Lo yarev lo yashchisu b'chol har kodshi kimola haaretz de'as Hashem kamayim leyam machasim. And there'll be no distraction because everything will be covered with the knowledge of God. So if you're to have to vote on this on a scale of 1 to 10, how miraculous does this sound, with 10 being the most miraculous? It sounds pretty miraculous, right? This sounds, there are lots of interesting things. The most miraculous part of this whole passage seems to be this: the natural instincts of animals seems to be broken. Right? That's what seems to be described over here. And so if we're to say, well, is the times of Mashiach going to be different? The answer is, oh boy, it is definitely going to be different. Hashem is going to change the mechanics of the world as we see it as of now. However, that might not be the way to read Yeshayahu. So let's come back to the Rambam himself. The Rambam himself, who is now reading, let's remember, this is the Rambam who just a moment ago said the Beis Hamikdash is going to be built by us, right, in a very natural way. So now the Rambam, with the same perspective, we're going to read these psukim in Yeshayahu, and this is how he says it. Al yale al halev. Don't think to yourselves, shibimoyz ha-mashiach yivatel dovo miminhago shel olam. Don't think that nature will change. Or yihye shum chidush b'mayse bereshis. Or that there will be shum chidush. There will be any change in the creation itself. El olam kiminhago noyheg. The world will continue in the same way it has been. It does sound pretty miraculous when talking about all these animals living together. Mashal v'chida inyan hadavar sheyiyu Yisrael yoshvim lavetach im rishay akum hamoshlim kezeev v'nomer. It refers to, it's a metaphor for us, the poor, downtrodden, that we're the domestic animal, always abused by the animals of prey. We're going to be able to live with our neighbors, and it's a metaphor for our peace with the future, in the future with our neighbors. Arvos yisharadim v'nomer shaked al arayim v'yachzru kolam adas al emes. Everybody will come to the right, the truth. V'lo yigazu v'lo yashchisu elo yoichlu davar emutar banachas im Yisrael shenema v'arei kabakar yoichal teven. And he says at the end, any time you read, says the Rambam, I'm not going to do an exhaustive list of every time you think something sounds miraculous. Any time you read something which sounds potentially miraculous, they're simply metaphors. They're parables. So you're going to ask me, okay, so what's the metaphor for? So he says, wait, we'll get there, we'll see what it's like. We'll see what Hashem really wanted to mean. We'll understand what the difference between the Za'ev is and the Nomer and the Dov. We'll understand what the Pesen is. We'll understand all those things when we get there. But understand, folks, it's not as it sounds. That's what the Rambam says. It's going to be a time where there's going to be peace. That's what there's going to be. But it's not peace without, outside the confines of the natural law that we've witnessed and we've experienced and we've documented up till now. That's the way the Rambam understands it. Fascinating, right? And then, of course, on there is a little asterisk on this Rambam. And that's where the Ravid disagrees. Now the Ravid, Rabbeinu Avraham, was also one of the Rishonim who felt it his role to disagree or to curtail the Rambam when he felt the Rambam was going out of out from normative we'll call it Jewish thinking. He felt that he attacked him on all levels. You know, they joke. The Rambam, almost every single page of Rambam has notes from the Rambam. They say, you know, one of the yeshiva jokes is, how do we know that that Hashem created the world? So I said, because the Rambam says it, and the Rambam didn't argue. It's like, you know, it's like one of those things. If the Rambam didn't argue, it must be its reality, right? So the Rambam argues over here, and he says in a very small line, and we have to think about this very carefully, what he says. The Hasagos HaRavid, he quotes, the first section is a quotation of the Rambam, from the period in Source 7, is the Aleph Aleph. Now, at first, when I used to come to Yeshiva, Aleph Aleph is an acronym. I used to think that's usually when you're reading in Rishonim, that usually means E.F. Shar. But that's not what it means, because it doesn't work. I couldn't understand why every Rambam started with the words E.F. Shar. It means Amar Avraham. He's quoting himself. He says, Abraham says, V'aloi b'torah v'avala b'torah v'ishpati chayara min haaretz. I'm going to remove the wild animals from the land. So what is the Rambam saying? Let's appreciate this. So he obviously is saying it's literal, but he's doing more than that here. You see, the Rambam has already sort of put a disclaimer on any other questions you could possibly ask. The Rambam had said, if you see any other miraculous sounding psukim, then understand that they're a marshal. Why does the Rambam feel that he has overridden the disclaimer of the Rambam? What is he doing here? Why is this more powerful? He's quoting a pasuk in the Torah. He's not quoting a shagal.
He's quoting Hashem, as opposed to...
Well, you could argue that Yeshayahu was by Hashem as well. I think that what he's saying is that he's saying, look, he has a pasuk in the Torah. This is this week's parasha. This is not Yeshayahu talking about vague pictures of the future. And you can now say, well, in the vagueness and in the grayness, I'm going to tell you what's going on. He says, no, this is a beferish pasuk in the Torah, that the Torah says there's no longer going to be wild animals. So says the rabbi, it must be miraculous. There's a point where you can no longer explain it being natural. This is what the Rambam argues. And in fact, if you read most of the, like, you know, the mainstream Mefarshim, you read the Ramban in the Shara HaGemul, where he talks about what the end of days are going to look like. The Rambam is pretty clear. He quotes a Medrash. He talks about 10 things that the world's going to look like different in those days. The light is not going to be from the sun. It's going to be from Hashem. Jerusalem's going to be of blue marble, of sapphire. He goes through a whole list of things. You know, there's not going to be crying anymore. Yeah, I mean, he's going to... He goes through all the beautiful descriptions of these miraculous transformations of the world. Most of the people understand that there was a miraculous transformation. The Rambam is the one who says no. And in fact, if you pull this backwards, this actually depends on a dispute which arrives a number of times in what's called Perek Chelek in Sanhedrin. The last chapter in the Gemara in Sanhedrin describes what the future will look like in certain ways. And there's a dispute between Shmuel and the Chachomim. And Shmuel's statement is, by the way, here are some pictures. There's the wolf with the liver of the lamb, and then, of course, the Yitzhak Rabin memorial. Do you know, anybody know what the memorial is over there? The memorial is where the weapons are being turned into plowshares. Right? The ideal of peace. That's another one of Yeshayahu's visions, which the Rambam takes very... will say, no, that's exactly what it is. It's just peace. It's not the miracles, right? There's the stamps of Israel. You'll notice it's interesting that in terms of the stamps of Israel... that the earlier parts of the psukim are worth less in the stamp, in the value over there. Just I think they are going sequentially in the psukim. Nonetheless, I don't think there's a hierarchy as to which is a more of a miraculous part. Nonetheless, the Gemara in Sanhedrin says there's a dispute, and we're going to go to the very end of it in Source 8, last line. To Amar Shmuel, Ein Beino Olam Azeli Mas Mashiach Elo Shibur Melchios Bilvad. Shmuel is the one who suggests in the Gemara that there's no difference between the world we live in now, the world we've experienced then, except for Shibur Melchios, which means... Shibud Malchios literally means
subjugation.
Means to say we're not going to be the bully child of the UN. We're not going to be the nation who is always under attack. We don't have terrorists planning day and night in all countries and financing all types of things to try to kill Jews around the world. It's going to be a time when there's going to be peace and people will recognize God. It will be easier to serve Hashem because we won't have this constant pressure all the time. But in terms of big changes, not really big changes. That's what Shmuel says. The Chachamim disagree with him, and that dispute sort of wound its way down into the more rational camps of the Rambam. And into the other camps, they say the Ramban, the Ravid on the other side. This is another example of where it expresses itself. The last one is where it gets fascinating, and that is who Mashiach will be. Okay, so we talked about who builds the Beis Hamikdash. We've talked about what the future will look like, but let's talk about the middle. Let's talk about who the Mashiach will be itself. So the Rambam says something really fascinating over here, and this gets into a very, very controversial part of our history. Because remember, folks, we've suffered many false messiahs before. Many, many. If you go through Iranian history, and see how many Yemenite history, see how many false messiahs we suffered from. You know, forget Shabtatsi. Shabtatsi is the end of the whole business. He was pretty terrible. But I'm saying there was many, many false messiahs in history. So Rambam talks about Messiah. He says the following. Take a look at this. This is so remarkable. This is it's a thriller just to read it. The Rambam says the following in source 9. This is again in Perek Yud Aleph in Mehilchos Melachim. He says, "V'al yalei datcho shamelech Mashiach tzorich la'asos oisos umovsim umachadish dvarim ba'olam." Don't think that the Messiah needs to come in, you know, whip out his wand and start doing miraculous things in the world, or to resuscitate the dead. That's not a prerequisite. We know how this is true. He says, because history told the story. Rabbi Akiva was one of the greatest sages of our times. He was a conduit of Torah Shebaal Peh. He reestablished the Torah conduit through him and his five students thereafter. And he believed that Bar Kochba, or Bar Koziva, as described in the other sources, was in fact Mashiach. He believed, he truly believed that Ben Koziva was the Melech Mashiach until he was killed in his sins. That's an important point in Mashiach belief. Is that if they're killed or they die, that's the end of the belief. He says, Kevon Shenehrag. Then it became clear that he was not the Mashiach. And nobody ever asked of Bar Kochba any signs that he should do miraculous things. Now it happens to be, it's interesting, if you trace this very, very sparse Agaras, which deleted, talk about Bar Kochba in general. But those which talk about him, there are Midrashim which talk about how strong he was. You know, that he used to be able to kick a stone and kill people with putting it by his ankle and throwing it onto other people. There are even far out midrashim which suggest that he used to blow fire, but some they say it was a trick that he did to scare people. You know, but in the end of the day, we don't have record of Bar Kochba doing miraculous supernatural things. He says, because the Torah is forever. Anybody adds, subtracts, or is Megale Ponim who tries to undo what the Torah stands for, Vohoitzi Advarim Shal Mitzvahs Mipshutan, or says that the Mitzvahs don't mean what they really mean, they mean something deeper. Hareze Vada Badai Rosh of Apikoros, the person who does that is a Apikoros. And he says now the following. He says, V'im Yamot, so what should the Melech Mashiach look like? He said what he doesn't need to do. So what does he need to do? So, you know, could anybody just stand up there and say, I'm the Mashiach? So Im Yamod Melech mi Beis David. So you have to have first of all lineage. Somebody who comes from the house of David. Hoigeba Torah, who learns Torah. Va'oisek b'mitzvos, and is involved in mitzvos. So first of all, practically speaking, the person needs to walk the walk, right? K'David Aviv, like David his great great grandfather. Kafi Torah shebichsav v'shebaal peh, and he keeps all aspects of the Torah shebichsav v'shebaal peh. You will notice historically, if you start reading the history of false messiahs, a lot of times, as they start rising to power, they start explaining that certain things aren't in full practice anymore. Kabbalistically speaking, we know that milk and meat is no longer as important as it used to be. Kabbalistically speaking, the fasts that we used to fast, they aren't as important because Mashiach is coming. Then you realize, there's something wrong. Right? There's something off. That is a sure sign that person who's talking like that is not Mashiach. Okay, and this is what happened, by the way. Unfortunately, read all the documentation. Those are usually the first steps that these false messiahs would say. He says, he'll fight the wars of God. By the way, you know, one could argue because you know, the wars of Hashem, are they the physical battles or the spiritual battles? You know, today it would be hard to know. If he succeeds, and he builds the base of Mikdash, right? That's one of the prerequisites. V'kibetz nidcha Yisrael, and he brings together all of those who are dispersed. Hareiz the Mashiach bevadai v'yitakein es ha'olam kuloi lavo et es Hashem biyachad, and he's going to create the whole world in service of God. Shneimar ki oz epoch elamim sofa brura likro lekula b'shem Hashem ul avdei shem echad. Nikotz pasuk v'im loy hitzliach. So you're going to say, well, what happens if it doesn't work out? Right, hang on for one second. Arkoi, if it didn't work out, meaning he got it some of the way, but he wasn't really all the way. Oi Nerag, or he was killed. Okay, so that's pretty good grounds to know that he wasn't the Mashiach. Shivticha Alav HaTorah. Varehu kachol malchei beis David hashleimim vaksherim shemesu v'lo yimidu hakodesh baruch hu elo lanasas boi rabim. So he says, then they no less than a fabulous king of the Malchus Beis David, who did amazing things in their days to help us, but they ultimately they weren't the Mashiach, and they were really a test for us to see if we'd still stick with Hashem even when our flagship goes down. Shneimar umin amachshilim yach ikoshlu litzroif bohem levarer lelabin ad eis kates ki od lamoyed, and he just quotes a pasuk, and then he said, and the pasuk is about how Hashem will smelt us, which means He'll cleanse us, which is a painful process. He says, Af Yeshua Notzri. Who's that? this is referring to Yoshka. Even Yoshka, Shedima Shiyeh Mashiach, V'Nerag B'Beistin. He seemed to be Mashiach. And how was he killed, by the way? The Roman describes it over here. He was condemned in Beistin. Now, whether they killed him or not isn't clear. But he felt that he felt pretty clear about that. Remember, the Rambam is writing from Egypt. He's living in Egypt, so he ain't under the censor right now. He's living under the rule of Islam. So he can say what he wants. So he says, "Venerag beBeisin Kabar Kvar Nisnabe Bo Daniel." And he says, "Look, Daniel talked about him, about this Bene Pritzi, this child is going to break through Gedarim and create all this damage." And he talks about this Yishmaeli as well, this Ishmaelite who refers to Muhammad. And he says that in the end of the day, all these folks were just were false messiahs who pulled us off the way to test us, and numerous Jews actually fell off the way along this particular path. You see, the Rambam has to address this, because according to the Rambam, you know, the Rambam, it's not somebody who's necessarily doing miraculous things. We're talking about a regular fellow, right? A regular fellow in the sense of what he's living in within the regular world. He learns Torah, he's righteous, he brings people back to tshuva, he fights the wars, but nonetheless, he's still within the operations of this world. And so the Rambam has to address, well, there's been many other private places that didn't work out. Happens to be, once again, on the Rambam, there's a nice little asterisk, and if you read the footnotes, where is the Rambam on this one? Oh, yeah, did the Rambam disappear? No, we are. There we are. Skip a page for a second, into source 11. The Rambam says, Al yala adat v'chuloi, Amir Avram, v'aloi bo'in koziva hoyo oimer, ono hu malko mishicha, v'sholchu chachomim lebodkoi, I moreach, the rabbi says, I have a different version of the story. You're telling me Bar Kochba was so wonderful, and the reason why he died, and we knew that the end of his reign came, was because he was killed. He says, I have a different version. I beg to differ. The version that I have, and the rabbi is actually based on the Gemara in Sanhedrin in Perek Chelek as well, is that what happened is he came to the soapbox and said, I am the Melech Mashiach, thank you very much. And the Chachamim said, well, actually, we have a list of prerequisites over here. One of the prerequisites is smell. Why do we know that the prerequisites are smell? Because we just read in Yeshayahu that Arichoy, that he's going to smell. And he's not going to judge based on his eyes or his ears, which means that he's going to be able to have a sense of truth irrespective of the regular senses, meaning to say, regular people have to sit there, judge, listen, look through evidence, hear it, contemplate, percolate. He says he doesn't have to do that. He's going to have a sense of what's correct, independent. It's almost like he can smell what's correct. He's going to smell who's true and not, says the Ravid, and because he couldn't do that, they killed him. He has a different version of the end of the story over here. Happens to be the all of Noisei Kalim on the Rambam try to understand, you know, maybe there are two different Agadas, because the Rabbi Akiva is based on a particular Agada himself. Maybe there are different versions. Maybe the Chachamim didn't kill him, but they let him, they rejected him at this point in time. Now, nonetheless, you see very different versions of what's going on over here. Just to appreciate what's going on at this time. Bar Kochba was post the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, just to appreciate things. Beis HaMikdash was destroyed in the year 70 Common Era, right? So almost 2,000 years ago. At such time, the Romans took full dominion over the state of Judea, but the Jews were allowed to live there primarily. There's a lot of Jews who remained. However, it was during the year 130 and 131 that Hadrian, who's then the Caesar, took a tour of the southern side of the Roman Empire. Now, the Roman Empire stretched, you know, well into the North Britain, down into Africa, and we're talking about, you know, vast swaths of everything we know today of the common of Europe and was covered by Rome. And so Hadrian took a tour in the spring of 131. He came to Jerusalem, and he felt that Jerusalem was a very important strategic place, because of course Jerusalem is, as we know today, is on the Fertile Crescent, which means to say it is the gateway to the south and the north. All the trade goes through Israel, right? So he felt that it was a very critical place. Also, it was well fortified because it's in the mountains on three sides. So what he did was he wanted to recreate it as a pagan state. Remember, Christianity was not Christian at all at this point in time. It only took to the year 300 in Constantine. But what happened at this point in time was he decided to flatten, to raise Jerusalem and rename it Elena Capitolina. Elena was his middle name. And he was a very humble fellow. And he wanted to establish a temple for Jupiter in the place of the Mikdash. And this is what historians say gave rise to the Bar Kokhba rebellion. Bar Kokhba at his heart had hundreds of thousands of soldiers on his side. He was an incredible military genius, as described. They said that to be able to join the Bar Kokhba army, people would have to put their hand in the fire until their fingers started dripping blood. That was the intake, you know, test for Bar Kokhba's army. They lived throughout the entire Shomron area. The Chachamim rejected that. The Chachamim actually argued on him in the Midrash as to his methods of cruelty. Nonetheless, they were able to push back the Roman troops from Jerusalem and from the Shomron and Yehuda area to the degree that how do we know this? Is because we have coins. So if you go now to the Temple Mount excavations, which is really a worthwhile activity, they have found coins there minted in Jerusalem with the name Shimon and the Esrog and the Lulav and the Migdash minted in year 1 and year 2 of Bar Kokhba's rule over Jerusalem. Right? I mean, say so he regained control of Jerusalem, but the Romans are not to be played with, and they sent in the 10th Legion into the Legion who had conquered Britain. They sent them down to Palestine. And what they slowly did was they focused on some of the smaller strongholds, took the smaller strongholds, and slowly took control of the whole Judah area. Bar Kokhba retreated into, not Jerusalem, Jerusalem's walls were too destroyed. He retreated into Beitar, which was fortified on most of its sides, and they had a stream and underground passageways. And for those of you who go to you have a chance to go to the excavations in the Yom Shoron, you can go in the caves of many of these the places of Bar Kokhba soldiers that were very thin at the beginning, so the Romans couldn't get their armor through. It's an amazing, amazing piece of history, and finally they weeded them out, and the Gemara says that Bar Kokhba actually killed his uncle, Rabbi Elazar HaMadi'i, I think, who was fasting on their behalf because he thought that he was a traitor, and then Beitar fell, and there was, Cassius Dio talks about the numbers of about 580,000 Jews killed in that particular siege. We're talking about where the Gemara describes blood running from Beitar to the ocean. Where, you know, this is the end of Jewish sovereignty all in all until 1948 in the land of Israel. We're talking about a very serious conquest. And at this point in time, just to put ourselves in Rabbi Akiva's shoes here, Rabbi Akiva says he is the Melech HaMashiach until the point that he died. It's not clear to me, and if anybody has any ideas on this, I'd be very interested to hear. When Rabbi Akiva died in relationship to Bar Kozim, Rabbi Akiva was also killed. He was also martyred by the Romans. And the Gemara describes that he was martyred because of his teaching of Torah, but it's not clear if he died before or after, whether he did or not notice this. But nonetheless, says Rabbi Yosef Carmel, this again falls in the same streams of thought of how natural or supernatural the experience of the end of days is going to be. Let's take a one step backwards, and this is where we're going to get perspective today. One further step backwards, and that is, maybe it's not just the Rambam and those who argue on him. Maybe it actually goes even further. So if you take a look at this, there's a beautiful Gemara which appears in Brachos. The Gemara is in Brachos Daf, in Tes Lamed Aleph. The Gemara describes a dispute between Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. The dispute is when did Yetzias Mitzrayim really take place? When did the Exodus take place? Now you say, well, that's pretty obvious, right? We celebrate Pesach on the 15th of Nisan. You're right. But when on the 15th of Nisan did it take place? So Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah says that the actual Exodus occurred at midnight. The strike of 12, and all the firstborns die, and Israel en masse exits the state or the empire of Egypt. Fantastic. However, Rabbi Akiva disagrees, and he says it happened in the morning. And there's a whole debate between the Pesukim, what do the Pesukim really mean, and there's Pesukim which indicate both ways. Hashem seems to say that they should only leave in the day, but at the same time it sounds like they're leaving at night. So how does it work? And there's proofs on either side. And the Gemara ends up saying that there's a dispute as to what the focus is. Was it the chipazon? Was it the rush or the confusion of Egypt? Or was it the rush or confusion of Israel? That's what the Gemara describes. Fascinating debate. Rav Yoel ben Nun has a very fascinating shir, which I've written down by Rav Chaim Jachter, who has a beautiful, beautiful description of here. Rav Yoel ben Nun, of course, is one of the heroes in the next week and a half, because Rav Yehuda ben Nun was one of the 55th brigade to liberate Yerushalayim in 1967. And he says the most beautiful insight into this Gemara. He says, look, he suggests based on sources that really Rabbi Akiva understood, they both understood that it had to happen by day. However, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah understood that at midnight what happened was day started dawning. Miraculously, the night ended and day started dawning, and that's when the Gula took place. So Rabbi Akiva says, no, if it's talking about day, it's talking about day. You had to wait for day. And Rabbi Nun suggests that maybe what's going on over here is exactly the same debate. How miraculous is Gula? How miraculous was Yetzias Mitzrayim? Was it that we had to wait until morning, like God commanded? Or no, God made morning happen when He wanted it, which was in the middle of the night. How miraculous was it? Who's on the side of the more natural is? Who waited until real morning is? Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva is the one who waited until morning. Now, how do we paskin? This is an important shala. How do we paskin in this halacha? What does this affect? What halachas does this affect when the geula took place? It affects how long you could eat the Korban Pesach. Meaning, could you eat the Korban Pesach until morning or until midnight? Right? How long does it affect? Is affected by the smach, I guess. And today, when we no longer have a Korban Pesach, what does that affect? Afikoman. When can you eat Afikoman? The reason why we try to eat Afikoman before Chatzos is in deference to Rebbe Elazar ben Azariah. Not because we paskin like Rebbe Elazar ben Azariah. It's a major debate between the Rishonim as to who we paskin like, Rebbe Akiva or Rebbe Elazar ben Azariah. We don't have a hachra. We don't know which one. So in deference to the one, we eat it before Chatzos. If you don't, you can eat it after Chatzos. Why? Because of Rebbe Akiva. Right? But that's how it affects ourselves, la halacha. It's quoted in the Bir Halacha in the source. So let's try to appreciate this. If that's true, if that you see this the debate of what the original format of redemption was, how natural or unnatural, supernatural it was, maybe that expresses itself in other places. So another example. Let's take a look at some of them. Example is, there's, you know, that famously when Israel left into the desert, it talks about how they had to live in these huts called sukkos. Now, what does sukkos actually mean? What does the word sukkos actually mean? So there's actually happens to be a debate as to what sukkos means. The Jews lived in these sukkos in the desert. So one opinion says that it was the Ananei Kol. They were protected supernaturally by these clouds of glory. Great. Happens to be that's not the only opinion. Another opinion is sukkos lavish. And they took a little bit of corrugated cardboard. And they took a little bit of plastic they found on the side. They put it together in that little shanty town, and they, you know, sort of wrapped it up every time they needed to go. And that was, and in the desert, that's how they lived. That's how it worked. Who do you think is the opinion of sukkos mamash? So Gemara and sukkos says, Rabbi Akiva is the one who says that was natural sukkos, meaning who is the one who is moving away from the supernatural expression of what sukkos was? Rabbi Akiva himself. Fascinating. In the same type of ilk. Similarly, now this you may argue with, but this is a fascinating addition that Rav Yoel ben Nun adds, is there's a whole debate about Shir HaShirim. Shir HaShirim, do you include in the canon of Tanakh or not? There are 24 books in the canon of Tanakh. That's canon with, people say, with one N. It's actually two N's. Canon with the one that shoots balls is with three N's. C-A-N-N-A-O-N. Three N's, right? Canon of Tanakh, that means like the everything that's included in Tanakh is C-A-N-O-N. Okay, different words, no shooting balls of iron. It's just means to say it's included in what Tanakh is. The general table of contents of Tanakh is Shir HaShirim included in that or not? There's a debate between the Tanaim, and the Tanaim go backwards and forwards, and Rabbi Akiva concludes and he says, Rabbi Akiva says at the very, very end of the Mishnah in Yodayim, in the third Perek, he says, let's take a look where it starts, three lines from the bottom, in the middle of the line, Rabbi Akiva is abbreviated as a Resh Ayin. Omer Rabbi Akiva in source 18, Chas v'sholom lo nechlak odom Yisrael ashtir ashirim, shalot tatami yasei yodayim, she'en kol ha'olam kula kedai, kiyom shenitan shir ashirim, v'yisrael shekol k'suvim kodesh, v'shir ashirim kodesh kadoshim. He says shir ashirim was always part of the canon, it was always included in Tanakh. There are those who argue and say, well, you know, what is the danger of including shir ashirim in Tanakh? Is that you may misinterpret it. You may think it's a very nice love poem. It's an affectionate relationship between two lovers, a man and a wife. So there's a danger. So Rabbi Akiva, no. He says the natural, that's where the kedusha resides, is in the natural. Don't start saying, well, you know, like it needs to be all metaphysical and all. No, there's beauty. There's spirituality found there in the Shir HaShirim itself, in the natural. take it further. There's a whole description over here as to what Bar Kokhba himself, as we saw a moment ago. Rabbi Akiva was not the one who was not agreed with in his whole generation. We saw this last week. The Talmud Yerushalmi says in Tanis Dalad Hay that Rabbi Akiva would say that he about Bar Kokhba, Dorach Koichov Miyakov, when the Yibilam talked about this star who's going to rise from Jacob, is referring to Bar Kokhba. Koichov is Bar Kokhba. And the Chachamim said to him, he says, you know, Rabbi Akiva, there's going to be grass growing through your innards before Bar Kokhba, before Mashiach comes. Meaning, Rabbi Akiva, don't get so excited about Bar Kokhba. This is before he died. Rabbi, you say that Rabbi Akiva was not agreed upon, because when they looked at him, they saw a warrior. They didn't see a tzaddik. Right? They saw somebody who was a mighty and fierce fighter, but they didn't see a Mashiach. And so therefore, Rabbi Akiva, they demurred. Rabbi Akiva said, no, this is what Mashiach could look like. We're going to skip the next one just for the sake of time, but I think this really relates to a little bit today as well. It relates to sort of the imperfection of the natural world. This Rambam, this next Rambam, which we're going to quote, is very fascinating, which is all remarkable. By the way, just to stop here for just a quick moment, the Rambam does paskin like Rabbi Akiva on the night of Pesach. I mean, the Rambam actually says that we go until morning because Rabbi Akiva, which is very much in sync with the Rambam's perspective of Rabbi Akiva, the natural type of way that Hashem interacts with this world. The Rambam now says in Hilchos Chanukah, the most remarkable Rambam. This Rambam, there's no way to be ambiguous about this. Listen to what he says in Source 22. Hilchos Chanukah, Perek Gimel. It's actually called Hilchos Megillah and Chanukah because it starts off with Purim and then this is the beginning of the Hilchos Chanukah section. Babayas Sheni, Kishamachu Yavon. In the second temple, when the Greeks ruled, Gazru Gzeros al Yisrael, Ubadlo Datam, Vilaynicho Eslan Asok Batar of Mitzvahs. They prevented us from involvement in all our spiritual activities. Upashlom Yobamamonam of Vinoseyem. They took our money, our daughters, Vinichnusullah Hechal, Uparzo by Protos of Timur Taharas, and they defiled the temple. But Sarla Hemli Yisrael Moed Mipnehem. It was terrible for Israel because of them. Velochtum Lachatz Godol. And they were under terrible pressure. Until the God of our forefathers had mercy on us, and until Hashem allowed the Chashmonaim to beat them and reestablish their malchus. And this is what the Rama adds himself. And they established a king from the Kohanim, from the base Chashmonai. V'chazru malchus l'Yisrael yeser al mosayim shana ad churban haba'a Hashem. And because of the Chashmonaim, Jewish sovereignty was reestablished in the state of Israel until the Second Beis Hamikdash. Now, just to appreciate this, the Second Beis Hamikdash was built under Persian approval, and when Persia was overthrown by Greece, it was under Greek dominion, which led to the Chanukah. Which means then to say that from the time of the Babylonian destruction, we didn't have sovereignty, right? Even though we had a Beis Hamikdash. This was the first time that we had sovereignty. Now, if you want to be very specific and you want to do a quick cursory reading of Josephus, Antiquities of the Jews, or you want to read some of the Gemaras that are far flung in between different places about this era of the Chashmonaim, you will notice that it is actually not such a rosy history. The Rambam talks about 200 years until the destruction of the Beis Hamikdash, in which the Chashmonaim were in control. It was not such a beautiful scene, if you read it. Now, you read about civil wars between different parts of the Chashmonaim family, killing each other, murdering each other, mothers, children, brothers, Aristobulus, Hyrcanus. There was to a degree that there was a siege in the Beis Hamikdash itself, where I think Hyrcanus was on the inside, Aristobulus was on the outside, and they had to bring up an animal over the walls just to bring the Korban Tamid while the siege was going on in the Beis Hamikdash, in killings, in families. One day they decided that they wanted to foil them, so they put a pig on the rope to bring up as the Korban. That was how they tried to foil the people under siege. Even more than this, in the end of the day, the Beis Chashmonai was completely eradicated. One of the servants of Beis Chashmonai was a man by the name of Hurdus, or Herod. He was a slave. He fancied one of the Chashmonaim young ladies, so he killed all his masters to take her line, her bloodline. She committed suicide. She jumped off the roof, and as she jumped off the roof, she said, if anybody tells you there's a Chashmonai, they are no longer, because I'm the last. And she jumped off the roof. That was the end of the Chashmonaim dynasty. Herod took over from there. He killed all the Chachmei Yisrael, except for Baba bin Buta, who, and then when he felt bad, that's when he started revamping the temple to the end of the second Beis Hamikdash. That's all included in what the Rambam says, the sovereignty returned to Israel for 200 years. Hurdus is in there. Aristobulus and Hyrcanus are in there. All this infighting, all the murder, all of the sieges, they're all in there. Because you see from here something interesting. The Rambam says, look, folks, you have to understand that Hashem operates Geula in natural ways. And even though even though it was a really terrible time in certain respects, we still had sovereignty, and we still have to appreciate sovereignty. You know, this has obviously caused ramifications today. You know, David Ben Gurion, right? You know, you think about the founders of the state, the framers of the state of Israel, and people point to all the problems. Okay, we've had problems in history. You're right. But this says the Rambam, Chazer Malchus v'Yisrael, might not be the ultimate, but that might be the way that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is acting in this world. This is how Rabbi Yoel ben Nun ends, and I think it's the most beautiful point to end with. It goes down to the story which we quote in the Haggadah, in the 25th source, and with this we end. The source tells us, the Haggadah tells us, Ma'aseh, there was a story by Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Tarfon, Shem of Subim of Bnei Brak. So they were all learning, they were all having their Seder in Bnei Brak. This Seder has so much to talk about. But right now, the two names which should jump out at us right at this point is Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, because they're disputees about when the miracle occurred, and hence, therefore, how long Korban Pesach can be brought, and hence, when the Sipur goes untold. So at this point in time, when we're reading the story, we're sitting on the edges of our seats, saying, when is the Seder going to end? Who won the argument? This will allow us to know the halacha for all generations. So that what happens? The Gemara says, V'ayu muslim sabrim yitzias Mitzrayim, kol oysa alayla. They spoke all night. Who's that like? That's like the opinion of Rabbi Akiva. So that's fantastic. Did they resolve it? What happens? He says, now we know that's fantastic. Why did Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah keep quiet? He disputed Rabbi Akiva on this particular fact. Right? What was going on over here? So many unfortunate that say, and as Rabbi Moshe is saying, is that it happens to be the location is significant. Why? Because the location is Bnei Brak. And if it's Bnei Brak, that is the place where Rabbi Akiva presides, and Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah was a visitor, and therefore in the place of Rabbi Akiva, he gave deference to Rabbi Akiva. Now you notice something very fascinating. You have two very, very different views of what Geula is supposed to look like. And remember, those views of what redemption is supposed to look like in Mitzrayim actually color the way they look at the reality they're living with. Right, they're living now in a post-destruction era, and they're seeing people who are saying, let's put together a rebellion. And you can imagine Elazar ben Azariah saying, wait for God. And Rabbi Akiva says, no, maybe this is God. Maybe this is the helicopter that God's sending in the flood. Right? You can imagine this colors their very way, their perspective of what's going on. And what Elazar ben Azariah says? He says, you know what, in deference to Rabbi Akiva, I respect Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Yoel ben Nun says, but you know what? Elazar ben Azariah's Talmidim didn't. He says, maybe the Talmidim had already left the Seder at Chatzos. That's why they had to come in the morning. So this is because the Talmidim had to come and say, I was only given one creation of Shoshakris, even according to Rabbi Akiva, you know, what's going on? Right? He says, you know, whichever way you do the Avnei Nezer, it doesn't make a difference. So what happens is, it says, Rabbi Obinun, he says, God willing, we should live in a time when we have the ability to be able to sit at each other's Siddurim, and whether you say this is the footprints of Mashiach, or this is not the footprints of Mashiach, whether the Beis HaMikdash is built naturally or supernaturally, whether Mashiach looks like that or looks like this, and we can sit at each other's Siddurim, and we'll be able to have an appreciation for the fact that there's two streams. And a message, and when it happens, we'll see how it happens. Bimherav Yomeinu. Thank you.